So we let the automatic reader here read up from page 56 on. We first again look at what he writes about the roots of Christianity. And some, for the most people, new information on Jesus. Some of you seem to have been very greatly interested in the report in my last book, Candlelight, about Jesus going to Japan and about the report of the brother of Jesus being crucified as a substitute. So perhaps I should do what so many of you have asked me to do, say a bit more about some of the old Bible stories. A surprising number of people have written to me asking, more. Obviously you must keep in mind at all times that there isn't much mention of any of this sort of thing, except in the Bible. For example, none of the great writers of round about 2,000 years ago wrote anything at all about Christ. That's a thought worth pondering. Any event nowadays is written up everywhere in inaccurate detail, and with all the trimmings that the press can devise. But throughout history great writers invariably wrote about events of moment, and the fact that none of the writers of crucifixion days wrote anything at all about crucifixion, implies that Jesus wasn't known, except to a very few people. Just remember this, Christianity did not come until long after Christ. Actually the foundations of Christianity were set at the Convention of Constantinople 60 years after the date of the alleged crucifixion. In the opinion of great Greek and Roman writers of the day, Jesus was a sort of troublemaker, one who had certain ideas, and at the present day we should say, oh, he's just a member of a hippie gang or the leader of a set of robbers. Shocked? Well, you shouldn't be, you know, because you were not there, you do not know the facts, you only know what has been peddled, sung to you through the Bible and Bible stories. Great writers of the day whose words have survived and reached us now made no mention of Jesus. Another thing to be considered is this, if a person were to be crucified and then at the end of the day the person was removed from the cross he could be revived, the crucifixion didn't kill him. Actually, being suspended by the arms, as on the cross there were very serious difficulties and obstacles in the matter of breathing. It was impossible to take a full breath, because to take a full breath means to expand the chest, and when one is suspended by one's arms that cannot be done. I have been so suspended in a prisoner of war camp so I can speak from experience. So the crucifixion wouldn't kill. Instead there would be extreme exhaustion and soon the person would sink into a coma during which his breathing would become very very shallow, growing shallower, so eventually you could say that he died of suffocation. I understand much the same sort of thing occurs when a person is electrocuted, in rapid electricity. The muscles controlling breathing are paralyzed or impaired, and so there is not enough air taken in to make available to the brain the necessary oxygen with which to sustain consciousness. So in that case a person lapses into unconsciousness, and if neglected the person would eventually die. If he could be removed from the source of electricity and artificial respiration given he would in most cases revive. I was going to tell you some very interesting things, true things, about certain aspects of prison life in the USA, but for some reason my publisher seems to think what I originally wrote would cause great alarm to American readers. In deference to my publisher I have to leave out certain parts, but I will suggest you get hold of a book or two written by former prison governors in the USA. Some of these men have written very revealing books about certain aspects of prison life in the USA, and although my publisher will not let me mention these facts, the American publishers of the prison governor's books are not so nervous. So, go on to your public library and see if you can find some titles of books by prison governors in the USA. Do you know, that in bygone, spunnen, days there was a definite law that, when a person was crucified the body should be removed at nightfall? Before removal from the cross the legs had to be broken so as to give the body an extra shock and an extra strain on the chest, and thus upon the breathing muscles. But let me remind you that in the case of Jesus it was specifically stated that his bones were not broken. So, if his bones were not broken, and if he did not get that extra shock, then possibly the body could have been revived. As I have said above, in the case of Jesus the body was removed without the legs having been broken and the body, no one has said it was a dead body, remember, was hustled away to a cave and there it was received by a very special, very gifted, band of men and women. You have heard of the Essenes, you have heard that they were a very special band of most knowledgeable people who had training and skills beyond the understanding of the average person in the street. They had an extraordinarily high knowledge of life and death, they knew what chemicals to use, they knew how to revive bodies. So in the cave very quickly pungent aromatics were administered to the crucified person, and chemicals were injected, and eventually the body, whether it be Jesus or the brother of Jesus or someone else, it doesn't matter, was revived. To refresh your mind a little further, remember the case of Lazarus. Lazarus was reportedly revived from the dead, wasn't he? Now, there is that definite report. There is the report, also, that Jesus revived him. Jesus was a member of the Essenes, so it is very likely that Jesus, a white magician, had certain herbs or powers with which he could accomplish these seeming miracles, and such a miracle was worked upon Lazarus who may have been in a coma. After all, there is a possibility that it could even have been a diabetic coma. Let me tell you something, I am diabetic, I have been in diabetic comas, and in such a state in certain conditions one can easily be taken for dead. Another type of complaint, which simulates death is the complaint of catalepsy. Many people suffering from that have actually been buried alive, because the true cataleptic can undergo all tests, except one, he has no responses, no reflexes, and a mirror held to his lips will not fog. There is only one test infallible in the case of the cataleptic, the test of decay. If a body dies it starts to decay, and after a certain time, one's eyes and one's nose give complete assurance that the body is indeed dead, but that does not happen in the case of a cataleptic. So possibly Lazarus was in a coma or cataleptic state and Jesus, as a member of the Essenes, realized the condition and had the ability to treat it. If we do not know the technique of a thing, then it becomes a miracle, doesn't it? Particularly, if, according to our own concept, it is against established law or belief or knowledge. Well, just remember, that there are a certain number of books in the Bible, but there were many many more books, which had to be omitted from inclusion in the Bible. The Bible, of course, is just a collection of books, as the word implies. Many other Gospels had to be left out, because they contradicted the testimony of the few who were published. Think of this, it is nowhere said that the Bible is true. Instead you have a statement the Gospels according to Street. Somebody. In other words, we are giving fair warning that this is not necessarily a true book, instead it is a book which has been reported according to the words of a certain person. It is much the same as saying, well, he told me that he thought. That is not saying that you know it for a fact. Instead, according to the language of the lawyers, it could be classified as hearsay evidence, not something which is given to you as utter truth, incontrovertible truth, but as a statement according to someone else. If you could get hold of other old books, papyri, or stone writings, you would find that there were truly remarkable divergences. Do you know, some books say that John never lived. Some people say that John was just a symbolical, a mythical, figure like John Bull in England or G.I. Joe in the USA, or, what is it? Kilroy was here. If you would do astral travel, as I suggest, you shouldn't have much difficulty in finding out these things for yourself, because there are still quite a number of documents going back 2,000 or 3,000 years or even longer which have not been discovered by physical man. But man in the astral, and woman in the astral, too, can find these things and can read them. There is a great advantage, because many of these papyri are stuck together with age, and if you tried to unroll them now in the physical they might shatter into dust, but in the astral you can go through them layer by layer without disturbing their physical structure. If you find that difficult to understand, get hold of a microscope somewhere and look at, let us say, a piece of rough stone. You can carefully focus your microscope and you can see different layers of the stone coming into focus, being quite clear, and then disappear to provide space for another focus. Anyone with a microscope can explain that to you. My wife has just read this and she has made a worthwhile suggestion. She said, why not tell them that some people believe that Sherlock Holmes was a living person? Well, that's a good point, a very good point, because Sherlock Holmes has been accepted as a living person and people still write to him. I suppose the letters go to the estate of Conan Doyle, but Sherlock Holmes was a figment of the imagination of Conan Doyle. We know there was no such entity as Sherlock Holmes, but popular imagination has clothed that imaginary entity with an existence. In fact, in England there is, I believe, a club devoted to perpetuating the legend or myth of Sherlock Holmes. More about astral travel. Well, I have mentioned using astral travel to get to see some of the undiscovered manuscripts, etc. During the past 20 years I have had an enormous number of people write and tell me that now they can do astral travel, they can experience the reality of what I have been writing about. They tell me that after the first initial struggle they felt that they had broken free and they could travel at will anywhere at any time. Unfortunately, a number of people have written to me calling me a fake, etc., and saying all manner of things, which I am sure they will regret, because they personally could not do astral travel. And I can only assume that, if a person has the wrong attitude, if a person makes the wrong approach, and has doubts or fears, then it's not so easy to do astral travel. To me and to thousands and thousands more there is no problem, or rather, the only problem is how to tell others how easy it is. Let's have a look at this astral travel thing again, shall we? You want to do astral travel, first of all, do you believe in astral travel? Are you convinced that there is such a thing as astral travel, which you can do given such and such conditions? If your answer is no, then go no further, because you will not be able to astral travel, unless you are thoroughly convinced of its existence. You have to convince your subconscious, because to my way of thinking the subconscious and the astral body are something like a boy holding a helium-filled balloon. As long as the boy holds on to the balloon it is quite literally attached to his body, but if the boy can be induced to let go the string then the balloon will float upwards. The astral travel condition is like that, so, first of all you must believe that astral travel is possible. Secondly you must believe that you can do astral travel. When astral traveling it is quite impossible for any entity or anything to cause you harm, unless you are afraid. Now, if you think that is strange just think of this, if you sit back comfortably in a chair and you think of some imaginary ailment, and you think of all the pain and distress that such an ailment could cause, you then think that you may have it so your heart starts to palpitate and you might feel a bit upset. Then you are sure you have something wrong with you and your heart races even more, and soon, because of your heart racing, you will get a gastric condition, you will feel bilious or something else. So it's quite possible for you to make yourself definitely ill, if you believe you have some illness, which is perhaps incurable. In the same way, if you try to do astral travel feeling sure that some bogey, Buseman, is going to jump out and pull your tail feathers or something, then you will be afraid to do astral travel and, in that case, it is a waste of time trying. So a third condition is that you must have no fear of astral travel. Fear will definitely prevent you from getting out of the body. Assuming, though, that you are convinced of the truth of astral travel, and assuming that you are convinced that you want to do it, and being certain that you have no fear, then really there shouldn't be any obstacle, unless you want to astral travel for a bad purpose. For example, and this is true, I have had men of a sort write to me telling me they wanted to astral travel so they could see girls in dressing and so on. I had one man write to me and tell me that he wanted to astral travel, so that he could be sure his girl was a virgin, before he married her. That, I assure you, is absolutely true, and it is a good way to make sure you don't astral travel at all. But assuming that you are able to satisfy the conditions, you believe in astral travel, you believe that you, given a bit of help, could travel easily, you have no fear and you have no intention of using the ability for anything wrong, then you should sit down somewhere, where it's not too light and not too dark. It must be just neutral. Sit down, so that you are completely comfortable, so comfortable that you are not aware that you are sitting down or lying down, and there are no sharp edges sticking into you. And then you definitely visualize yourself getting out of the body. Breathe regularly, make deep and rhythmic breaths, and then let your eyes, which are closed, roll up, so that you are, in effect, gazing at a spot somewhere near your hairline. If you are bald, you have to imagine where your hairline would be. Your eyes, then, should be squinting to a slight extent so that their focus converges, as I have said, about the hairline. Just take things easy, there's no point in rushing things, no point at all, let things go at their own speed. Then either one of three things will happen. You might suddenly find that you have made a jerk. If you jerk, then you might come back straight into the body, because it means that you got out of the body and then took fright. The fright will have sent you right back in again. There is nothing to be worried about in that. You can, if you like, sigh with exasperation and start all over again. The second thing that can happen to you is that you might feel a very, very slight, well, I can only say numbness, which might start at the feet and spread upwards. It isn't quite a numbness, really it is indescribable, unless you have actually had it happen to you. It could be numb, it could be a slight tingling. But, anyway, it is something different, and you have to try to ignore it. It is perfectly normal, anyway. Some people after this find that they are almost in a cataleptic state, their muscles tighten up, they will not be able to move. Well, be careful, whatever you do, don't panic here, that is a very, very good sign, because you have your eyes shut, remember, and yet here at this stage you will find that you are able to see through your eyelids, but everything will have a golden tinge. And then, when you have reached that stage, you will find a swaying sensation and out you will go straight into the astral and you will see things brighter and more vivid and with a greater range of colors than you ever thought possible. In the third condition, when you have rested you will find, possibly, a swaying. You will experience a sensation that you are going through a tunnel toward a light at the far end of the tunnel. You will be drifting upwards like a piece of thistle down on an evening breeze. Keep calm, that's all to the good, because soon you will find the light is growing larger and larger, and then you will drift out of this tunnel and find yourself in a far greater light. You will find that you are actually in the astral world. The grass about will be greener, far greener than you ever thought possible. And the waters about, perhaps a lake or a river, will be so clear that you will be able to see the bottom. It's a wonderful feeling, a wonderful sensation, and if you think of going to a certain place there will be a sort of link and you will be at that place. Suppose, for instance, you've got out into the astral and for a time you float a few inches above the ground, just looking about you, marveling at the conditions, wondering what to do next. You may want to explore in the astral world where everything is brilliant, where the colors are brighter, where there is a tingling sparkle in the air. Well, do so. It certainly will revitalize you. It will build up your psychic powers enormously. It is far better to do this and have some spiritual feeding. If you do that, you will find you will have no difficulty whatever in getting into the astral on any other occasion, but if you want to rush off somewhere for some materialistic purpose, then you will find few shocks.
Suppose you want to go and see Mr. X to see what he is doing. Immediately you think of him and think of his location, you get there, but you have left the brilliant surroundings and the healthy atmosphere of the astral world. Instead you are back on Earth again, in the astral state, admitted, still seeing things, as people see them on Earth, dull colors, dull people, muddy water, and if your friend, X, is in a commercial mood you will find that his colors are pretty dim too, and you won't like it a bit.
My definite recommendation is that those who get into the astral world should stay in that world for perhaps half an hour to get accustomed to it, because then they will find it so very much easier to get into the astral on other occasions. The big difficulty is with most people that they start off very well indeed, they start getting into the astral, and then their body creaks, nurker, they feel strange tugs and swayings, sometimes they get almost airsick, because they are in such a state of nerves. Well, they get out of the body and then they panic, oh, what, if I can't get back in again? Immediately they have the thought, bonk. And they are back in the body feeling, perhaps, a bit dizzy. And if you do ever get back into the body like that and you feel sick and dizzy, then make sure you lie very still and try to have a sleep, even though it be of only a few minutes, because, until your astral body can get out of your physical body and realign itself and so enter correctly, you will have quite a bit of indisposition. So, no amount of aspirins will help you, all you need is to get out of your body again and back in properly. It's like getting up in the morning and finding you've got the wrong shoe on the wrong foot. You wouldn't want to go about all day like that, so you change your shoes to the right feet. In the same way, get out of your body again and back in properly. So that's all there is to it. I say that anyone who can comply with the conditions can do astral travel, anyone at all. But if you are afraid or, if you are doubtful, then don't waste time, because you won't astral travel. More about religion, first of Buddhism. Let me return to the original theme of this chapter, religion. I have said a few things about the Christian religion and about the various fighting factions of that religion. I have said that I have no religion, as Buddhism is not a religion, it is a belief instead. Alright, what do I think of Buddhism? The more one studies Buddhism, the more one can appreciate the intrinsic, I-boned, value of it, as a guide to living, and the more one can realize that Gautama was negative in his outlook. My personal belief, which I have never put in print before, is that Gautama, the prince, was too utterly sheltered from the hard facts of life, and then, when he suddenly became confronted with suffering, pain and death, then it turned his brain, it gave him a severe psychic shock, it upset his sense of values, it destroyed something essential to his being. So the prince Gautama left the palace, left all the comforts he had known, and became utterly disillusioned. My personal belief is that he became negative. If one studies the teachings of Gautama, let us say Buddha, which is more normal to Western people, one will appreciate that Buddha was negative, everything was no-ness, all life is suffering. Well, we know, that isn't true, don't we? There are good times in life as well as bad times. So I believe that Buddha became far too negative in his outlook, but at the same time he did produce for the world some very very valuable precepts, and it was founded on the much older religion of Hinduism.